Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City, NPR News Talk 90.7, putting Delmarva first. It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
Affairs of the heart and the consequences of war, they're all part of this year's edition of the Delmarva Review. Welcome to Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. As we do once a year, we take a look at the annual publication by the Eastern Shore Writers Association, where fiction mingles with poetry and features local and regional authors. In studio, Wilson Wyatt, chairman of the Delmarva Review Editorial Board. In addition, we have a couple of the contributing writers on hand. Ann Caldwell is an award-winning poet and English instructor at the University of Delaware, and Ian Baer of Annapolis and New Orleans. He is an award-winning author of fiction and nonfiction. Welcome to you all. I want to start with you, Wilson, and give us a little overview about the kinds of writing that you came across this year, and if one were to open up this little book here, what would one find?
Well, hopefully everyone will find something they like. We're real pleased with this particular issue. It's our fourth one, and there are 33 writers that are represented in the book. Most are from the region, but some aren't, as you may know. We have writers from, in this particular edition, from seven other states, and two foreign countries. But the writing is varied, but hopefully it all comes down to two magic words: compelling and memorable. So whether it is, as you say, writing about the heart, or stories from war, which we do have some subject matter dealing with the war for the first time in this edition, or whether it's like the feature poet finding tapes from her father and writing poems that reflect what she remembers from him. So I guess the answer is memorable, compelling, something that touches the heart, your heart, as a reader.
Now, you, as a matter of fact, profile John Barth. Tell us a little bit about him, the profile done by John Lewis. Why was he significant, and why did you decide to profile him?
We decided that the Delmarva Review, which is still relatively new as a literary review in the world's eyes, although it's moving right along, I think, that we should feature some of the great writers that have touched this region. And certainly among those who are still living is John Barth. John, as they call Jack, those who know him, Barth is from Cambridge, and has quite an illustrious history, being, if not the father of, certainly the representation of the postmodernist era of fiction writing, which is quite an accomplishment for any writer, coming right out of Cambridge Public School, going to Juilliard to play the drums, realizing he couldn't play the drums so well after all, and going to Johns Hopkins to get his college degree. And then he started teaching, and most recently, well, for the last 22 years, he was a teacher at Johns Hopkins, and really responsible for helping to develop that writing program. So he was a natural choice for our first interview. And we went to John Lewis because he's the arts editor of Baltimore Magazine, and he has he's an award-winning writer and interviewer, having done pieces on Hunter Thompson and various other writers and artists. So we wanted from him a few nuggets that linked Jack's background, his life, to why he wrote the way he writes, which some would say is in circles.
I was going to ask you, we were talking about postmodernism. Can you give us a sense about what all that's about? Because obviously you read a bit of him. If I were to open up one of his works, what would I be finding? How would it be different, do you think, then?
Well, first of all, by the time you finish the first page, you will know it is different. His writing and postmodernism, I'll start there, is a postmodernism is a movement that was in response, if you will, to the Faulkner, John Crow Ransom era, if you will, of realists. Basically, the theory, if you take it to an extreme, the theory that all stories have been told, and that mythology is all stories have been told in mythology, really that all that's left is storytelling and the story itself, which is what Jack Barth or John Barth is famous for. He's famous for telling stories that deal with storytelling and with storytellers, and weaving a little of himself and a lot of the Eastern Shore into his writing.
There's a sense, by the way, that I don't know if it was a direct quote from the profile, but he tends to write sideways. And there's actually a comparison with the blue crab. Tell me a little bit about that. When I'm reading something of his, how does that work when I'm reading something, when he writes sideways? What do you think?
Well, I thought that was a clever metaphor of John Lewis's in his essay, talking about linking the blue crab that we all know to writing sideways, which will not be the first time that John Barth has heard that. I mentioned writing in circles and writing sideways, one thing leading to another, maybe not thinking linearly, so to speak, one sentence naturally following the next, one paragraph naturally following the next, but instead going off in a whole other direction, sideways, if you will.
Finally, is in the piece that there's a sense that his father plays a certain prominence in his life, and that they both are storytellers, even though one's really a writer and another one seems like he just simply told stories.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
His father was known in Cambridge as Whitey. That was his name. And famous for telling stories, not writing, but storytelling. And apparently telling them very well and short. Storytelling being a something that in rural America is quite an art and used to be around the potbelly stove and in the in the local general store. And Whitey was very good at this, apparently. In fact, in the interview that John Lewis did, he came across one resident who said, "Yep, Whitey was a great storyteller." I said, "And his son would, if he could do half as well, he'd really be something."
Well, I want to now turn to poetry, and we have Ann Caldwell here. So, first, give us a little sense about your own background. How did you get into writing poetry?
I actually started writing when I was a child. I think I always loved poetry. My parents encouraged, writing in the house, and there were. There are stories about my dad and my mom writing down, little things I would say and keeping them. And so there was always sort of an idea in our house that reading and writing was certainly important and respected. And so, I kept that love for it, all through school. I always, wrote and prized the things that other people wrote. So it was an early love.
What do you think is the... is a secret to writing good poetry?
Oh my, the secret to writing good poetry. I think that poetry is trying to take the language to the edge of the inexpressible. That poetry is, in a way, it does a little bit like what dreams do. How you can wake up and you know that you have emotions and there are images in your head, and as soon as you try to express them to somebody, they almost vanish. And you end up saying things like, "It was my house, but it wasn't my house. And it was my father, but it was a tiger." And and so I think poetry has the ability to move the language toward that moment of the inexpressible. So I think that the secret of good poetry in some ways is to allow the language to move in that direction, not to try to force it to come back.
I mean, one of the things that struck me particularly about poetry is that it's almost as if when the words come together, they have a life of their own that express an idea that you may not have intended at the time you put them together.
Yes.
I mean, is that a good description? I mean,
absolutely. Right. So you can start out thinking that you want to write a poem about something. Although I think that, you know, probably say this happens in prose too, but you start out thinking about what you're going to write about, and then it goes in a sideways way. it goes in a direction that you don't expect, because the words themselves have power, have weight, and they take it away that you don't expect.
I mean, it almost seems as if sometimes when you put a combination of words together that are not necessarily ordinarily put together, that you seem to create new ideas and new images.
Yes, absolutely.
Why don't you read a little bit about? I guess you have a couple of them, but one is Eve. Why don't you read a bit of that for
Eve.
Us?
Eve. This is actually a poem that I wrote. It's a strange poem for me because it was an occasional poem. So it was written for the dedication of the statue of John Milton in Milton, Delaware, which is where I live, and they asked me to write a poem. And so it opens up with lines from John Milton, the great poet, and lines from Paradise Lost. And these lines are my favorite lines in Paradise Lost, because they're this moment when Eve has gone off and eaten the apple, and she comes back, and the whole time that she's been off talking with the serpent, of course, Adam has been weaving a garland of roses for her to wear. And when he sees her, he immediately understands what she's done, and that she has succumbed to temptation. So it's a poem about temptation, and it opens with these lines from John Milton from Paradise Lost. From his slack hand, the garland wreathed for Eve down dropped, and all the faded roses shed. I consider Eve, my mother, wonder if I should sin. On the table, his offer, twice a year, no consequences. Knowledge, again. I'll know the exact taste of his skin, the scrape of his teeth on the back of my neck. Will be the fruit and the fallen. But we'll go by degrees, in twice yearly appointments, punctual, like dental cleanings. I'd rather fall like Eve, my mother, and stumble half drunk from the tree, find Adam and his crown of roses, weeping with despair and need, climb him, wrap myself around him, cling until fiery wings and swords rout us from a paradise always ours, never seen.
You said that you were inspired, obviously, by Milton. Is there something deeper that this comes from, do you think, for yourself as a writer when you were writing it?
I think the interesting thing to me about, you know, we always fall for two things. We fall for love or knowledge. And we desperately want to know things, and love, of course, that always, it both transforms our life and also throws us off track all the time. And so I think that part of the thing that I'm interested in the poem is the way that love and knowledge play out in this moment, that what Eve gets offered is love and knowledge, and that every time we get tempted, we get... It's sort of the same. So I'm playing with that mythological point of view. But also, I think at the end of the poem, talking about, you know, if you're going to go, don't go twice yearly, you know. Don't go in something, you know, where you plan it, you schedule it, you write it on, you know, it's in your calendar. Oh, good, it's that time of year again. That doesn't seem to me the way to go.
Now, if you could, as a matter of fact, if you turn to the other poem that you have, it's very short. It's called The Line. Read that for us. And we'll talk about it on the other side.
Okay. It's a tiny little short poem, Line. A snake slants through another poet's verse under the covers of my bed. When it ropes my feet in the dark, I start.
And my question after I read it a number of times is, what are you trying to say there?
That one is talking about how inspiration begins, but also about how frightening it can be. So that idea of I start, I think both means I begin and I start, like I am startled. And it's about how literally what happens in the poem, the situation of the poem, was that another poet's line stayed with me and stayed with me and stayed with me for a long time, until I start to dream that other line. And when it when it ropes my feet in the dark, you know, when I can't get rid of it, then I have to do something about, I have to write it out of myself in some way. So I begin. But that's definitely a poem where I think you're right on the edge of what in the name of all that's holy are you talking about? You know, right on the edge of the inexpressible.
Well, I want to now turn to Ian Baird. Ian, why don't you first tell us a little bit about your own background before I get to the story that you wrote. How did you get involved with writing?
Well, like Ian, I've always written, and mostly for pleasure, but I also did a lot of expository writing in my job. I've always been interested in writing and being a writer. But I was also very interested in international relations. And so that became my day job for many years. And I worked for the federal government in the area of international trade. When I retired from that, I decided that it was time to take the writing more seriously. And my wife and I, she's also an artist, she's a painter, we moved to New Orleans and lived there for over 5 years. And that's where I really spent my time writing hard, and went to a wonderful place called the Loyola Writing Institute, and learned more about the craft and began to get stories published. And then we had that wonderful event, Hurricane Katrina, and went through that, and that gave me the impetus to write a memoir. And so wrote that, was fortunate enough to have that published, and so now I'm just enjoying this writing life.
Well, tell us, Lynn, a little bit about the story that you wrote, The Gildermeister.
The Gildermeister is a story about a veteran who loses his legs in the Vietnam War and becomes a bit destitute. And he spends his summers in Washington, D.C. on top of a dolly with a harmonium in front of him, singing the blues with his hat on the pavement collecting dollar bills. And this turns out to be quite lucrative. So when the weather gets cold, he packs up his goods and heads down to New Orleans, where he has an apartment, and straps on his artificial limbs and becomes a man about town known as the Gildermeister. And he sort of appeared as a lot of the writing I do is character driven, and he kind of appeared to me. And then it was, well, you've got this guy and you put him in New Orleans, what's he going to be doing? And the story developed from there.
What should we do? And then just a little for us there.
Sure. This is the excerpt I'm going to read is sort of how he got his name. The whole thing had started with the shoes. He'd just been Ronnie Jefferson on that day some 10 years ago on a visit to New Orleans to see his sister, a sometime jazz singer on Frenchman Street. He'd strapped on his legs and was taking a stroll up Magazine Street, looking for a place to grab a beer and an oyster poor boy, when he saw the shoes in the window of Bertha's Vintage Emporium. Shiny gold shoes that looked like they might just slip right onto his prosthesis. And damned if they didn't. He thought how nicely they'd go with the gold-handled walking stick presented to him by the members of his platoon as a talisman of hope after the bouncing Betty took both his legs in the Delta north of Canto. The golden bowler and tie soon followed. The 24-carat grill work for his teeth were a later addition, a year or two after he had already been baptized at Sonny's Bar one night in a river of a beat of beer. "Who you trying to be, Ronnie?" asked Monkey Man. Name not for the way he looked, but for how he danced. "What's with the shoes and stuff?" "He trying to be that guy from the Bond movie. Goldfooter or something," said Renee, draped across the bar only a knot or two from oblivion. "Just trying to add a little class to the joint," said Ronnie, tipping his gold bowler. "You gold, Ronnie, solid gold," said Monkey Man, trying to stay on Ronnie's good side, seeing that he was doing the buying. "Yeah, you is the Goldermeister, okay," added some drunken tourist from Holland, decked out in shorts and walking shoes. He'd made a left when he should have made a right and ended up in Sonny's Bar on the wrong side of Rampart Street. The Gildermeister. Or at least that was the consensus on what the Dutch guy had said when everybody sobered up a bit the next day. The Gildermeister. Yeah, that would do.
What kind of person or what kind of character do you envision this particular person being. Obviously, he's gone through the Vietnam War and lost his legs. We've mentioned that he was also a sniper. Who is he? How would you describe
him? I think he's a very resourceful, strong character. This is a guy who's, obviously had his leg shot from under him. And he has found a way to survive in this world, and not only survive, but to thrive. And I see him as really a sort of an object of hope and resilience, and also takes it all with a good bit of humor. And I think those are characteristics that are appealing.
But, by the way, did you draw on any particular people for this character?
I had heard a story many, many years ago about an amputee who was a panhandler in Washington, who, when he died, there was an obituary that he had moved to Florida and retired. And I thought that was kind of amusing. How do you become a panhandler and retire in Florida? So that guy sort of stuck in my mind. And so he became sort of the idea for the Gildemeister.
Is this the first time, by the way, that you've written about war or the aftermath?
Yes, I think it is. I think it is the first time I've written about war, yeah.
And does it say anything about how you felt about what happened back then, or?
Well, I was one of those young men in 1968 who went home from school for Christmas, and on Christmas Eve arrived home to find my draft notice. So I had, it was not unique, but I had the pleasure of both marching against the Pentagon and serving for the U.S. Army. So it was kind of schizoid that way. But, I remember those days very clearly, and I think there were a lot of young men, like the Gildemeister would have been, who were sent into that meat grinder and came back broken.
Did you go yourself personally?
I did not.
You did not.
Not.
But where did you serve, by the way?
I served in Hawaii.
Well, that's okay.
A little ways from Vietnam.
I can work with that. One also want to finally turn to a story that actually caught my eye, Mrs. Morissette, and it's by Margaret Roddenberry. And so I want to turn back to Wilson here for a moment. And tell us a little bit about this story. As a matter of fact, before we went on the air, you were talking about how you'd actually sort of mold this story for the last couple of years. Tell us a little bit about your connection to this story.
Well, it's when the story came to us at the Delmarva Review, all the readers, we have everything we publish is read by at least three different people. And so when it gets to the editor, it's been approved, if you will, with some degree of subjectivity aside. This one came in with high marks from all the readers. But it stirred a lot of controversy in the discussion because it didn't follow all the typical literary rules, if you will, the things you learn in your MFA program in grad school. However, it breaks rules, but it does it successfully in some of our views, and in other views it doesn't. So, but the important thing is that the story has a resonance with it, that it has humor, it's compelling, and it's memorable for sure. And people of this age group who hear it have been stirred by it, and so we're very pleased to publish it.
Why don't you read just a little bit of it in front of you there?
Well, it has some humorous moments.
Indeed, it does.
And it's essentially about a relationship, a man and his wife, in their middle years and moving onward. And this particular passage is when they're in the islands on vacation. And I'll read from it. Relishing the sight of women, young and old, slim and plump, strolling the narrow beach, breasts fully exposed to the Caribbean sun. Perhaps those Frenchies had it right after all. He turned to comment to Mrs. Morissette on the variety of bosom shapes. You could do a scientific study, my dear, something on the order of phrenology using calipers. only to find his wife pulling down the straps of her navy blue one-piece skirted bathing suit. As he watched, his mouth corked with horror. She maneuvered her arms through the straps and folded down the top so that the fleshy rubber cups lay empty and open to the sky, like offering bowls to the altar of her plump tummy. Her large white breasts, her husband of 46 years old, rarely saw without a maiden form, were dangling out in plain air.
And in a story, we won't give it all away, but in a story, this seems to be the beginning, at least, of a certain, I don't know whether it's necessarily rebelliousness, but a breaking out of this mold that these two people seem to have lived in for a long time. Tell us a little bit about how.
Yes, I think this. Story involves several things. It involves loss, and it involves discovery, and what is life about. And it's through this relationship where I think this couple's relationship grew as a result of the independence that Mrs. Morissette exhibited. And it may have been shocking to her husband from time to time, but he learned from it, and he grew from it.
Do you think we talked about this story appealing to obviously people older and their age group. How do you see, or did you have reaction to people who are younger who are reading this story?
In trying to get a variety of people to read this story before we published it, I presented it to some other people who were young, and they got the same reaction that I got. When I would watch them read, and all of a sudden they'd burst out into laughter. And I knew that it was striking home, if you will. So it gets a universal reaction, I think, from most people. And if you're the audience for a literary review is first writers. Those are the people who are most interested. But other people who are interested in good quality writing will pick up a literary review and just like they might get the New Yorker and read something, and they'll find something that's universally that attaches to them universally, and I think this does.
I mean, it certainly is compelling. You mentioned a moment ago that it breaks some rules. What kinds of rules does it break?
Well,
and does that contribute in any way to its effectiveness, do you think?
The first time I read it, I could see a basic rule that you're taught in fiction writing being broken, and I recognized it right away.
It is basically that
everything has to be earned in what you write. So when you write description, it has to relate specifically to the plot. And the end has to be earned by the beginning and the story and the action that takes place. The very definition of fiction is an action. Something has to have happened to the main character, and that is the story. And the character has to change. I'm saying these as rules. Well, in this story, it's not so easily abiding by those rules. But if you look deeply at it, the main character did change and affected the lives of others. And it's really quite a touching story once you get beyond the humor of it.
I mean, it does. You're right. There's a final moment where it all seems to come together that it almost belatedly, almost in some ways, I think.
Exactly.
Yeah. So how would you assess, so we only got about a half minute left, how would you assess in the kinds of material that you guys got this year as opposed to maybe last year or year before? Is it getting better?
It's getting better. We're very pleased. We're always nervous at the end. please someone send us something we want. There were 1,000 submissions this year. I shouldn't say that publicly, but I will. So just to give you an idea, we had 1,000 submissions, and of those, we took the 33 writers that, and two of whom are represented here very nicely, I might add, and So we're pleased. It is competitive, but by the same token, it's a real opportunity for a writer, because if you have something that you're proud of and it's good, we offer a pretty good opportunity to give it a chance to be published. Some literary reviews, there might be 10,000 submissions. If it's a magazine like the Atlantic or the New Yorker, your odds are you'll get a little printed note back saying, not even thank you. And we're very interested in the Eastern Shore and the Delmarva Peninsula for our writing, and 70% of it comes from there.
We've been speaking with Wilson Wyatt, chairman of the Delmarva Review Editorial Board. Caldwell, an award-winning poet and English instructor for the University of Delaware, and Ian Baird of Annapolis and New Orleans, also an award-winning author of fiction and nonfiction, talking about the publication, the literary magazine called Delmarva Review. I'm Don Rush. You've been listening to Delmarva Today, and thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Our volunteer producers are Penny Hartman, Kathleen Grout, and Jim White. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.